Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast series looking at the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And this is episode II, Caesar the Politician. When we last left Caesar, he'd entered military service, he'd become a priest, and he'd briefly been captured by pirates. He's now reaching the age where he can start to think about a political career. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
One of the lowest rungs of the political magistracies is quaestor, and you can become quaestor when you're 30. There are very strict rules about this.
Yeah.
And he does that. He's the quaestor in 69 BCE, and it's also a kind of a great year for him. This is going to sound weird in terms of being a great year for him, but there are two important deaths in his family. His wife dies, and his aunt Julia, who was married to Marius the warlord, dies. Now, you might think that's not a particularly wonderful thing for him personally, but what it gives him the opportunity to do is to make speeches at their funerals. And this is an opportunity for him to speak in public, because these two women are given very public funerals, which is quite unusual for women at the time. So he really uses them to forward his political career, especially with Julia, to make that connection with Marius. Because Marius had been a very important military and political figure in Rome. And so he wants to make the connection back to Marius's military victories in particular. And we know from independent evidence, like the orator Cicero, that he was a great speaker. Cicero says he could have made oratory his career if he hadn't wanted to go into the military or concentrate more on the military. So he makes these very great speeches, and that really sort of puts his name on the boards. That's when he becomes a serious contender.
Contender for a further political career.
Exactly, yes.
So where's the starting point of this then?
Well, being quaestor is the first rung, and he now has some political power, particularly over financial matters. But of course, there are lots of quaestors, okay? The political system in Rome is a bit like a triangle, in that there are lots of people at the lower ranks. There are then fewer at the next rungs up, things like praetor, and there can only be two consuls per year. So there are lots of people who are never going to make it to the top. He's managed to get to the first rung, and he's managed to make himself stand out by giving these great funeral speeches, but that doesn't assure him of a future career. He has to get voted in again, and he is voted for by the people. And the way you do that, or the number of ways you do that, are by making great speeches, having great military victories. He's already started with a military career, and spending loads of money on the people. So you put on spectacles for them, you put on gladiatorial games or theatrics, or you give them donations. All right, things we would regard as bribery, but perfectly normal in the Roman political system.
So this is what he does he?
Well, he hasn't got the money, of course, but he starts borrowing it in huge quantities. Just gets into enormous debt that we can't even contemplate. And clearly, somebody sees promise in him. We think he's borrowing from a very rich man at the time called Crassus, who's going to be really significant in Caesar's career. And Crassus, if it is Crassus, seems willing to just keep lending him money.
So at this point, I imagine the way to get ahead politically would be for Caesar to make some very careful strategic political alliances, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And in the 60s BCE is a time when things are really, really starting to grind to a halt in the late Republic. Power is being held onto by a small group of families, and this is pretty frustrating for Caesar and also for a man who's had huge military victories, Pompey. They kind of come together to try and break this stranglehold. They're not particularly natural allies, but they've got something in common in that Caesar, it's pretty clear, is becoming what will eventually be called a popularis, a man of the people, a popular man. It doesn't mean he's a democrat. People used to translate it like that. What it means is that he gets his power base from the people. Pompey isn't a natural popularis at all, and he will end up on the other side of this battle, which is called the optimates, or the best men, who are much more into hierarchy and structure. But he does want land for his veterans. He wants to settle the veterans of his army on land, and Caesar wants land reform. This has caused all kinds of conflict for decades in Rome. So the two of them form a kind of informal alliance, and they get a third man involved in this, who's called Crassus, the man who was probably lending money to Caesar, who again isn't a particularly natural ally, but seems to have seen that this would be a good power base. And they're informally called the First Triumvirate, which is the first group of three men banded together. And they have no constitutional base for this. It's probably all done in secret at first, at least. And the way that they seal the deal is that Caesar's daughter, Julia, marries Pompey. So again, we get marriage as a politically strategic move. Pompey, we know, was born in 106 BCE. So if we agree that Caesar was born in 100, Pompey is 6 years older, and he's marrying Caesar's daughter. We don't know exactly when she was born, but she's the daughter from his first marriage to Cornelia. So she's probably born sometime in the mid to late 80s. She's a lot younger than Pompey. This is a huge age difference, even by Roman terms, where it would be normal to have, I don't know, 15, 20-year gap. And it's a marriage that does at least potentially generate children, although unfortunately Julia dies in childbirth. But it's something that brings Caesar and Pompey together. Caesar becomes Pompey's father-in-law, which is a bit weird because he's younger than him.
Around the same time, Caesar gets married again, doesn't he? Is that also a marriage for political reasons?
It's a marriage that we don't know too much about. He marries a woman called Pompeia, but this is not anything to do with an alliance with Pompey. She's not closely related to him. The main thing we know about it is why it broke up. And that's because somebody called Clodius kind of invaded a private ceremony that was meant to only be for women, which was being held at Caesar's house. Caesar, at this point, had gotten another important priesthood, the most important priesthood. He was Pontifex Maximus. He was chief priest. So this is part of his rise to power. This is not something that means he has to stick around in Rome, but it's a really important, influential role, and one that he holds for the rest of his life. And then it's something that the most important man in Rome will always take on, and in fact, Pontifex Maximus is still the name that the Pope uses for himself.
Wow.
He is the Pontifex Maximus, the chief priest. So it's something with a tradition that comes down to our day. So Caesar's chief priest, and because of this, his wife gets to hold this ceremony, the ceremony of the great goddess, in her house. There must be no men present at all. But Clodius, this rather tricksy figure, invades the ceremony, apparently to meet with his lover, who's also present there, one of the women there. He dresses up as a woman, but he gets discovered. And because of this, Caesar divorces Pompeia and says that this is where we get the phrase about Caesar's wife from. I don't know if you've... The phrase is Caesar's wife must be above suspicion.
Right.
So he's saying, I don't believe anything went on, whereas it probably did. But Caesar's wife has to be above suspicion. And it's sort of like saying, you know, I must look squeaky clean, which is sort of hilarious because Caesar was known to have affairs with married women throughout his life. And this is part of the sort of risky behavior that Caesar adopts. And similarly, he sort of risks his career a lot of times by getting involved with the wives of elite men. And he just seems to have been addicted to having affairs with these women. He could have had affairs with prostitutes or courtesans or less elite women, but there's a theory that he sort of liked the danger. He's always at risk of making political enemies by doing this.
This is Caesar, who's also referred to by his enemies sometimes as Caesar, Queen of Bithynia.
Yes. The story about that comes from early on, and perhaps something I should have gone into when Caesar was trying to make his mark early on in the East. In that he's supposed to have had a relationship with the king of Bithynia, Nicomedes.
He spent too long there, didn't he?
He did.
And everyone got suspicious.
They did.
Yeah, so it's kind of an amazing little bit of double standards there. Maybe it was a convenient reason to get divorced from his wife.
Maybe so. The Nicomedes taunt is something that's used about him throughout his life, but it's very typical of the kind of cut and thrust of Roman politics. they find something to fix on, and they say, oh, you're a, they call it a canidus, which is a particularly nasty taunt. But he does divorce his wife at this point. He probably hasn't spent that much time with her, but he's on the way up and he can't risk any scandal at this point.
So as a result of being a part of this gang of three, does that extend his political career at this point? Does it have the effect that he wants?
Absolutely. He has the support of a really influential person in Pompey and another influential person in Crassus.
With deep pockets.
Both of them immensely rich. And it's in their interest to get Caesar into the consulship. And so they no doubt fund that, because Pompey knows if Caesar gets to be consul, then he will get the land settlement for his men. And that's what he's after. So Caesar becomes consul in 59 BCE. And it's a very, very controversial year, because getting this land reform through makes him a lot of enemies. Perhaps the most famous one is Cato, often called Cato the Younger, who really hates the idea of this, because he's a senator, a magistrate, and a lot of the more traditional senators don't want land reform, because power in Rome is based on land, and these senators have vast amounts of land. So they just say no, no, no. And it's kind of their hard line that's going to lead to conflict at Rome eventually. And they hate Caesar. They're sort of a minority in the Senate, but they're vocal. And they try and stand in his way at every turn. And he starts using the power of what are called the tribunes of the people, who have the veto. They're meant to protect the ordinary people, to get around what these people keep trying to do. He's consul also with one of those conservatives, a man called Bibulus, which is a really funny name because Bibulus means drunkard now. There's always two consuls every year. And the purpose of having two consuls is that there is balance, because they can veto each other. All right, so nothing new can happen unless everybody wants it. This leads to a very conservative state. But at the first outing of the land bill, Bibulus gets up to veto it. And Caesar says, well, okay, I'm going to take it to the people, which is entirely illegal. Mm. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. The people vote for the consuls, but they don't get to make decisions after that. And he takes it out and makes this great speech to the people that he's probably organized to be in the forum. So Bibulus has to respond, and there's basically a riot, and he gets a big barrel of dung thrown at him, poor Bibulus, and then never appears in public again. And basically, during that year, which the Romans name years by who's consul that year, it's meant to be the year of the consulship of Caesar and Bibulus, people start calling it the year of the consulship of Julius and Caesar, because Bibulus is nowhere to be seen. He has no authority anymore. He's effectively been drummed out. And of course, this means Caesar has a lot of power and he gets to do what he wants. But it also means that there's lots of people feeling more and more angry with Caesar, that he's sort of taken this power all to himself. So there's trouble brewing. He's setting himself up to have enemies who really detest him, at the same time that he's getting very popular with a lot of the ordinary people and a segment of the Senate too.
So if you're only consul for 1 year, where does that leave Caesar to go after he's held this position?
After you've been consul, it's normal to go and govern a province. You get called proconsul then, because you sort of still retain a lot of the similar powers as consul, but not in Rome itself. And he sort of manages it during his year as consul that he will get to be the proconsul of Gaul, which at this point is actually just a tiny little bit of southern France that we call Provence, and a bit of northern Italy, which technically doesn't have Roman citizenship at that point, and also a little strip of what we think of as Croatia. So it's a sort of weird province because it's a bit all over the place. But he does this strategically because he knows there's the rest of Gaul, France and Belgium, to conquer.
It gives him a big frontier to work from.
It gives him a place to conquer. It gives him a kind of field of glory. And he knows he can make his name even more. He can get even more honors by doing this. He'll get a triumph out of it. By the way, we should mention that he gave up a triumph to be consul, which is, you know, the height of glory for a military leader is to hold a triumph, a huge parade in Rome. He wants to go out and earn one now in Gaul, and that is exactly what he does.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University, and you've been listening to the podcast series Emperors of Rome. You can find this podcast on iTunes and SoundCloud, where you can listen to other episodes, subscribe, share, and leave us some feedback. If you want to follow us on Twitter, Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we'll discuss Julius Caesar and his campaign in Gaul. Until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.